The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. This fall, continuing education at PAFA is partnering with Arts Philadelphia to offer art classes for those suffering from dementia and memory loss and their caregivers. Students can experience how art making can unlock creativity, create new memories, and strengthen relationships with a new sense of community. Includes facilitated discussions in the PAFA Museum. More at 215-972-7632 or pafa.edu/ce.
The World Meeting of Families is set to offer 10,000 tickets to the public tomorrow for Pope Francis' speech on Independence Hall. I'm Tom McDonald, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Dave Heller has a well-deserved night off. According to WHYY's Marielle Segura, people can try to claim a ticket starting at noon.
To hear Pope Francis speak about immigration and religious liberty in front of Independence Hall in person, you need a ticket. They're being offered first come, first served, and they're being made available at noon at worldmeeting2015.org/tickets. When SEPTA tried to sell regional rail passes for the Pope's visit on a first-come, first-served basis, its website quickly crashed. World Meeting of Families spokesperson Meg Kane says the event is working with a third-party vendor to create a website that can handle the tremendous demand for just 10,000 tickets.
We feel confident in the system that's being built, and we feel that it will allow all who wish to access these tickets to do so.
For those who don't get tickets, the Pope's speech will be played on jumbotrons across the city, as well as broadcast. The World Meeting of Families plans to offer tickets online Wednesday for those hoping to attend the papal mass on the Ben Franklin Parkway. Marielle Segura, WHYY.
Philadelphia school district students will arrive for the first day of classes tomorrow morning. As WHYY's Kevin McCory reports, educators are cautiously optimistic about the new year, but worries remain.
After years of budget cuts and dwindling classroom supports, Philly educators say they have much to be optimistic about. First-year Governor Tom Wolf is pushing a budget plan that would drastically increase school resources statewide, and Democratic mayoral nominee Jim Kenney has put schools at the center of his agenda.
But at the same time, I'm extremely anxious about the fact that we still don't have a state budget.
Marge Neff is the chair of the Philadelphia School Reform Commission, which oversees city schools.
We're going to start yet another year without adequate resources to schools.
Teachers echo that sentiment, nervous that no state money has arrived. Amy Rote teaches English as a second language at Feltonville School of Arts and Sciences.
And the thing that maybe is most scary is people are getting used to this. This deep, deep austerity, this deeply cruel system. I guess for your sanity, you have to just keep going. But it's still an unacceptable situation.
As state budget negotiations continue, Philadelphia teachers are also anxious about another big decision that will happen in Harrisburg. Barbara Keating teaches English at South Philadelphia High School.
Waiting for the Supreme Court to make a decision has everyone on pins and needles.
The Pennsylvania Supreme Court will soon decide if the district has the power to unilaterally void the teacher's contract. It attempted to do so last year by imposing health care concessions on teachers to save money. But the lower courts have sided with the teachers, who are entering a third straight school year without a contract. For WHYY News, I'm Kevin McCory.
Philadelphia's City Council returns on Thursday from what could be called a summer recess. But don't call it summer vacation. As Council President Darrell Clark explained, the summer is a time for a different kind of work in the districts.
Members really do need to get out in their council districts. During the course of the year, I can't tell you how many times people tell me they don't get an opportunity to see you in the district. You don't come to look at things in the community. You can't make meetings during the course of the day. And that's factual because we're in here doing our business with respect to public hearings and all the other issues associated with the legislative assistance. But as soon as we conclude that, we are out in the street in a very aggressive way. We are in a position to provide constituent services much more aggressively because the council person can physically be out in the street during the course of the workday when the rest of the government is in action. So it gives us a good chance, and people really appreciate the fact that the person that they voted for, they actually have that opportunity to talk to that person directly, and we take full advantage of that during the summer months. In addition to which, the city of Philadelphia is a place where we do festivals, block parties, you name it. We're going to get 3-4 people together. We're going to have some sort of an event, and we are required to attend those events, but it gives us an opportunity to touch base with residents.
Now, this could be considered a lame duck session of council. What are your legislative priorities going into the fall and wrapping up the year?
Yeah, well, there are a couple of initiatives that we'd like to conclude, understanding the simple reality as it relates to the end of an executive branch's term, i.e. mayor's term. To put any new broad-based initiatives on the table may be somewhat difficult to get passed by the end of the term. But we have been talking about, obviously, schools. We do have a bill pending, an appropriations bill for the additional $25 million to schools. We will have to conclude that process. We are aggressively in the midst of putting in place the community schools program that we feel very comfortable with. We've gotten significant buy-in by stakeholders, the union membership of these schools, the school advocates. So that is something that we want to conclude. We also are going to be discussing some changes in governance as it relates to the way PGW functions. That whole conversation centered around whether or not we should sell or maintain PGW in public ownership. We understand, based on the ability to be viable and the ability to be competitive with the private sector, we need to talk about an aggressive approach to changing the governance. So we'll be talking about that when we get back.
What about once Harrisburg finally completes their budget process, dealing with what's left?
Well, I mean, I don't know what's going to come out of Harrisburg. The people who actually work up there don't know what's going to happen in Harrisburg. The reality is there are a couple of things that are being discussed with respects to school funding, changing the formula as it relates to having a more equitable approach to funding, particularly urban schools. An issue with respects to charter school reimbursement. All of those things will obviously create much more resources for schools. But the simple reality is the enactment of those things will require a tax of some sort. Most people talk about Marcellus Shale. If and when that happens, it will fill a significant gap with school funding. There are a couple of other issues that we like to see in the General Assembly. Basically being in a position to impose taxes at different rate as it relates to commercial versus residential and create a much more equitable environment. That's something that we'd like to get from Harrisburg.
Do you see a lot changing in the next couple months because you know you've got a new administration coming in, you're going to have new priorities?
I know that what people call the presumptive mayor, Jim Kenney, has been meeting with members of council. I understand that those conversations have been positive based on every member that I've talked to. We hope to hit the ground running. We need to be supportive of the next mayor. I think that the presumptive mayor haven't had an opportunity to serve in this body for a long time, putting in place and participating in the formulation of a number of strategies that we will be moving on will put us in a much better environment to move those initiatives forward. So I think that there will be a broad-based consensus from day one on a number of issues.
Council President Darrell Clark, thank you for being on Newsworks tonight.
Thank you very much.
During the 70s and 80s, America lost millions of acres of family farms. Agriculture was specializing and growing bigger industrial-sized dairies and croplands with monocultures of corn and soybeans. But more recently, other changes have come along, such as local foods movement and women taking a bigger role in agriculture. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant talks to some of today's female farmers.
Gwen Volkert and her husband milk about 50 goats every morning and every evening at their farm in Northeast Ohio. They've trained them to hop up on a wooden milking stand. While the goat eats, they attach tubes to its backside and turn on the milking machine. Volkert is a computer sciences professor. She says they've been working on this goat cheese operation for the past 10 years, ever since a work trip brought them to Paris for a night.
Of course, the only thing I wanted to do was eat cheese.
They did, and it was so much better than what she could get in Ohio then.
And I simply stated as a fact that I'm going to make goat cheese. So, and then my husband said, I think you'll need some goats for that. And I go, well, that settles it. We need to get goats.
Volkert is part of a trend of women who aren't necessarily farming to make a living. They want to provide better food for their families and communities. The U.S. Department of Agriculture says most farms owned by women have sales of less than $10,000 a year, and they account for only 3% of total U.S. sales. But there are also many women who want farming as a full-time career. Researcher Carolyn Sack says many cringe when they're called hobby farmers.
Women are really furious when you say that it's their, I mean, they're oftentimes not taken seriously as farmers.
Sachs is a professor of women's studies at Penn State University. She's written 3 books about women in agriculture.
All of our women farmers say, are you kidding me? This is the hardest work I've ever done. You know, why would I do this if it was just, you know, if it was just for fun? I'm trying to make a living.
Women farmers have reason to be prickly about it. Until 2002, the USDA didn't even count most of them as farmers. The farm census had a space to list one operator. On family farms, that usually meant only the husband was counted. Women were largely invisible. Sack says there are many reasons farms owned by women tend to be smaller with less acreage. For one, many larger farms are still passed along from father to son. She says women have found an important role on smaller and mid-sized farms.
A lot of these women, even if they've grown up on farms, aren't tied so much into this sort of masculine role of success, of getting the biggest equipment you can, you know, farming as much acreage as you can, that they don't have that as part of their identities. So it's not as much of a risk for them to try new things.
NSEC says many younger women are getting into farming, even if they didn't grow up in agriculture. Beth Lomsky is 26 years old. She manages a 2-acre demonstration farm near downtown Cleveland. It's owned by a not-for-profit organization. She grows blue and white potatoes, herbs and sunflowers, all kinds of stuff. Lomsky's part of the new wave of farmers, selling directly to customers at farmers markets. But she's not in this just for fun. This is her career.
There's definitely this myth that you cannot make a living from the land, and sustainable agriculture is fun and it's a hobby, but you'll never pay the bills. But that's totally, totally false.
Once she has a little more experience, Lomsky plans to start her own orchard with apples, pears, and cherries. She may be a woman, but she really just sees herself as a farmer. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
The Allegheny Front is produced in Pittsburgh and reports on the environment. You can learn more at AlleghenyFront.org. Taking a look at today's headlines, Republicans who control the Pennsylvania legislature have begun planning their next step in the 2-month-old budget stalemate with Democratic Governor Tom Wolf. The Senate will be back in session mid-month, and Republicans say if there's no movement in the budget talks, they'll pass a stopgap plan. Wolf isn't saying whether he would sign such legislation. Vast stretches of the iconic tall grasses that dot the Atlantic coast were destroyed during Superstorm Sandy, removing a vital protective buffer for the region's shoreline. Now the New England Wildfire Society will collect the seeds of those native plants to reproduce them to coastal areas. The society says the project will help make these habitats more resilient to future storms. The society and its partners will be collecting at wildlife refuges along the Atlantic coastline, including sites in Delaware and New Jersey. Taking a look at the weather, clear skies, lows in the upper 60s, partly cloudy and hot with high in the low to mid 90s tomorrow. Wednesday, some thunderstorms, highs in the upper 80s. Currently, it's 89 degrees at WHYY. Still ahead, just in time for Labor Day, the American Swedish Museum has an exhibit about labor activist Joe Hill.
There is definitely a mythology around Joe Hill.
That's coming up as NewsWorks Tonight continues.
The National MS Society supports WHYY and announces the Bike MS City to Shore Ride, offering something for every cyclist, from a 25-mile route to a 180-mile course over 2 days on the back roads of South Jersey and finishing in Ocean City. you can register as a cyclist or volunteer and celebrate the 35th anniversary of City to Shore and 35 years of showing support for the thousands of local people living with multiple sclerosis at bikems.org.
Widener University supports WHYY. Widener offers over 60 undergraduate majors and concentrations, including communication studies, computer science, business administration, and more. Widener is hosting a Widener Day open house on Saturday, October 10th at 9 a.m. It's an opportunity to explore campus life with a guided tour, meet with professors, and chat with current students. That's Saturday, October 10th at 9 a.m. Registration available now at widener.edu/openhouse. Widener leadership works.
Supporting WHYY, Devereaux, one of the leaders in behavioral health care, helps to provide care for children and adolescents with mental health challenges, as well as individuals of all ages living with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Across its national network, Devereaux helps provide meaningful care to individuals and families where they need it most. Whether it be through community and educational programs, employment services, foster care assistance, or individual or group living support. Learn more at devereaux.org.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Tom McDonald, in for Dave Heller. On this Labor Day, we remember Joe Hill, a labor organizer and songwriter who died 100 years ago. He was executed by firing squad in Utah for a crime he did not commit. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports on a small exhibit about Joe Hill at the Swedish American Historical Museum in South Philadelphia.
Joe Hill was Swedish. He immigrated to America as a young man after both his parents died. He rode the rails as a migrant worker, picking up jobs wherever he could all over the country. He got involved with the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, or the Wobblies, organizing, drawing cartoons, and writing songs for the Radical Labor Union. Historian Alexis Boos says he preferred not to perform his own songs.
He wrote the songs to be sung by crowds. Something that's interesting is he really picked up on what the popular songs were today, of the day, and rewrote them to be about struggles. So he'd take Tin Pan Alley songs and vaudeville songs and write new lyrics.
Boos is the editor of a forthcoming book of letters by Joe Hill, mostly written while in prison. Hill was convicted of murdering a shop owner in Salt Lake City in a trial considered a frame-up by industrialists who wanted to squash the labor movement. Woodrow Wilson himself tried to intervene, but even the President of the United States could not stop his execution by firing squad on November 19th, 1915.
There's definitely a mythology around Joe Hill. You know, Joan Baez and Paul Robeson popularized a song, I Dreamed I Saw Joe Hill Last Night. Lately, Tom Morello from Rage Against the Machine has been singing it, and Bruce Springsteen's been singing it. So whenever people want to remember a labor martyr, Joe Hill is the first natural idea.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night.
But he wasn't completely comfortable with that status.
While waiting to be executed, Joe Hill wrote to his supporters saying, "Don't waste any time mourning. Organize." It was one of the last letters he would write. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
The next solar eclipse will occur on Sunday, but as Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute, explained to NewsWorks Tonight's Dave Heller on this week's Sky Talk, you'll need to travel pretty far to get a glimpse of it.
Let's head south. We're going to go very, very, very far south. And if you haven't been over to the Indian Ocean, here's your opportunity to dip your toe in those waters because, as it turns out, at the end of this week, there's a partial solar eclipse. The only problem, though, with this partial solar eclipse is that it is very partial indeed. So here on the Earth, the shadow of the moon, which is what the solar eclipse is all about, is only going to graze the surface of the planet. So if you happen to be in that part of the world, your best bet for seeing any real shadow is going to be on Antarctica. But here's the real setup for this. You know, in a solar eclipse, the situation is that the moon passes between the Earth and the sun. And if everything is just right, the positioning is perfectly correct, the shadow of the moon actually falls down and touches right onto the surface of the Earth. And that's the darkest portion of the shadow called the umbra. And it's this that creates the totality that everyone looks for in this great celestial event. Well, in this case, as it turns out, the moon is just a little bit too far away from the Earth. And that means that the umbral shadow won't touch the surface of the planet. It's not really the best opportunity for a solar eclipse, but if you happen to be there with some penguins, maybe it's a good thing to do.
A lot of miles, partial solar eclipse, I'm not so sure. What if we stay home in Philly? Isn't there a correlation between solar and lunar eclipses?
Yes, in fact, that's the better bet, because following this partial solar eclipse, just 2 weeks later, there happens to be a total lunar eclipse right here in the Philadelphia area.
Wait, 2 weeks later?
2 weeks later.
What's the date?
Well, I think it's a very auspicious date indeed. Yes, Sunday, September 27th.
Pope Francis will be in town.
Is there any connection between those two at all? No, it really is just coincidence that Pope Francis happens to be in the Philadelphia area while this total lunar eclipse is taking place. But this total lunar eclipse also has some other qualifiers to it. Not only is it just a total lunar eclipse that'll be visible to everyone if the sky is clear on that evening of September 27th, but it's also being billed as a supermoon total lunar eclipse. It's the idea that the moon, in its perigee, its closest approach to Earth, allows the moon to appear larger and brighter. Now, this particular one, this month, this particular month's perigee, happens to be the closest approach of the whole year. This perigee happens every month as the moon makes its orbit around the Earth. But I'm not so sure we really want to think of it as being super big or super bright. I mean, if you were to actually go out with a measuring device and measure the difference, you might be able to make that measurement, but it's not going to appear enormously bigger or enormously brighter.
Coming back to this week, what is available to be seen in the night and pre-dawn sky?
Well, in the evening, the great thing to still see low in the southwest is the planet Saturn. It's not far from the bright star Antares. That's part of the constellation Scorpius, the Scorpion. So that's down on the southern horizon after the sun sets. But in the pre-dawn sky, gosh, that's where all the action is happening, because around there we can find Jupiter, Venus, and Mars all around on that side of the sky. They'll be right under the bright constellation Leo, the Lion, a springtime constellation that's happening to rise just a bit before the sun, so you can catch all of those things then.
All naked eye viewing?
Yes, they are all naked eye viewing, but the thing is, we have to be kind of cautious about Mars, because Mars is the smallest and dimmest of the three that are there. Jupiter, of course, being the largest, is closer down toward the eastern horizon, while Venus is up fairly high. And of course, Venus is brilliant bright white, so you can't miss it. Jupiter doesn't have anywhere near the bright whiteness, but it still stands out as an object separate from the stars, because as we always say, stars twinkle, planets don't, and that's the way you can separate, in this case, the planets from the surrounding stars.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight.
Derek Pitts spoke with NewsWorks Tonight's Dave Heller.
Space is the place. Space is the place.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov and Kimberly Haas. Host Dave Heller will be back tomorrow. You can listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. Tomorrow is the first day of classes for Philadelphia, and we're going to return to one school we've been tracking for over a year. The chronic underachievers have been engaged in a turnaround effort in one of the most poverty-stricken neighborhoods in the city. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom McDonald for NewsWorks Tonight.
Fringe Arts supports WHYY. Available light, choreographed by Lucinda Childs, with music by John Adams and set design by Frank Gehry, is a monumental work of art by three modern masters who share a minimalist approach to dance, music, and architecture. A singular experience, created by the luminous score, industrial set, and precise choreography. Available Light is on stage this week only as part of the 2015 Fringe Festival. More info at fringearts.com.